Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
In what many would call true political fashion, late Friday afternoon, an announcement was made public by Governor Lamont's office. He announced that the ratification of the agreement his administration reached on the 35 collectively bargained contracts with the State Employees Bargaining Agent Coalition. His administration had transmitted the contracts and accompanying details to the Connecticut General Assembly, and they essentially have to give it the thumbs up for it to go through. But these wage contracts, they were tentatively agreed upon in early March and were ratified by the respective unions just last week. By statute, these contracts now go before the state legislature. As I mentioned, it includes wage agreements of 2.5% increases for their wages, step increases retroactive to July 1st of last year. It also will look like some payments, some bonuses of $2,500 for the first year for those active employees. The cost estimates for these new wage contracts are still under development. Of course, this is according to the governor's team, and those estimates will be reviewed by the Office of Fiscal Analysis when the final package is submitted to the legislature. Interestingly enough, in the middle of last month, Ken Girardin of the Yankee Institute wrote an article, "Secret Union Talks Equal Big Public Costs." So I wanted to have Ken back on the show this morning to talk about what does this recent announcement mean? And if you're not a state worker, especially, what does it mean for you, the taxpayer, or especially if you're a worker who's not really getting compensated because of the pandemic, unlike state workers are? So, Ken, welcome back to the show. Good morning. Thank you so much for being here.
Good morning, Melissa. Good to be back.
So let's go to your article. What were some of the biggest things you were highlighting for your readers?
Well, just to give folks a little more background, these are the union contracts that cover the bulk of the state workforce. These are the deals that cover everything from what their wages are going to be to what their work rules are going to be. So these contracts cover everything from the rules about overtime to literally, in a lot of cases, what a state worker pays when they go to the cafeteria in a state building. Mm-hmm. So these are extremely detailed documents that control not just how we compensate state workers, but really how state agencies are operated. Mm-hmm. And how state services get delivered. So these are extremely important documents. They make a lot of decisions that I suspect people think are senators and representatives make in the General Assembly. But really, for the past several decades, these are decisions that have been made in negotiations behind closed doors, where the governor's folks go in for several months. They come out, they say, here's a document, and give it to the General Assembly and say, approve it or don't. Now, you mentioned that the General Assembly is going to vote on whether to ratify these deals. Believe it or not, that's a big improvement over where we were not just 5 years ago.
Why do you
it
say that?
It used to be that these deals were deemed approved automatically.
Really?
If the General Assembly did nothing. And
oh,
it was
wow.
up to the General Assembly to try to override them.
Okay.
So what you have is ultimately a second lawmaking process. If people remember that Schoolhouse Rock, how a bill becomes law, this would be the real dark goth version of that.
Just a bill
and
on Capitol Hill.
Really, yes, it would be just a bunch of laws being written behind closed doors by often. And this is one of the really scary parts about this. These negotiations are being done with both sides recognizing that they are going to potentially come together to seek an endorsement and to try to influence an election less than a year away.
Mm.
So there's a huge conflict of interest whenever somebody goes into the room, which is why these negotiations, first off, shouldn't have been happening behind closed doors. And after they did, when these agreements were announced on March 8th, I sat down on my computer and I said, okay, I'm ready to read the deals. And more than 3 weeks went by before these deals were actually released to the public. So state lawmakers have been waiting more than 3 weeks for these deals to come out. And what they got was more than 1,700 pages dumped on a Friday afternoon in a way your more computer savvy folks will appreciate how awful this is. These were scanned documents all put together in one file. So you can't search them. You can't look for concerning words. You can't go, you can't easily jump to certain sections.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent most of the past 3 days going through these one image at a time and writing down the really concerning stuff. To talk brass tacks for a moment and just talk numbers, what the governor has agreed to is an immediate $2,500 bonus, an immediate retroactive raise or two, retroactive to last July, for all state workers covered by these contracts.
Mm-hmm.
They get an automatic 2.5% cost of living adjustment, and they get what's called an increment raise or similar seniority-based raise for what's typically 2%. So what that means is every state worker is getting this retroactive raise of 2.5% to 4.5%, depending on who they are. Then they're getting another raise in July, and they're getting another $1,000 bonus. These,
wow.
So you're talking about what averages out to about $2,000 in retro pay immediately, $2,500 bonus immediately. Then you've got another round of raises. Then you've got another bonus. This is a really expensive deal.
I was just going to say, any idea can ballpark how much money the state is spending on this or would be spending on this?
The governor had set aside about $300 million just to cover raises and bonuses. And we're adding stuff up right now to see what came with that. The floor that all this is being negotiated on is pretty high. That is to say, you hear a lot from the unions about years of sacrifice. They love to talk about the years that they had wage freezes in the past, the year that they made concessions,
mm-hmm.
like agreeing to pay 1% more for their health insurance, up to a 15% cap, by the way. But you hear a lot about that sacrifice, but this deal does not match reality in the private sector. This is an extremely troubling deal if you're a taxpayer. It's a troubling deal if you're a state lawmaker who's worried about balancing the budget more than 1 or 2 years out. And the real question is, what did the governor get in return? Now, there's a time and a place in negotiations
mm-hmm.
where if you have a bad contract, and in a lot of ways, Connecticut had bad contracts. If you had a bad contract that was, say, making it really hard to terminate bad employees, as Connecticut contracts do, and you were to say, we're going to give everybody a $3,500 bonus in return for the governor taking back the power to terminate an employee who is doing naughty stuff at work
mm-hmm.
or who is just really, really not performing. If you were to get that in return, I could understand a little more of the generosity on the pay side. But I'm having a really hard time seeing what the governor got in return. They make some small tweaks here and there, but the governor could really help us if he just came out and said, look, here's what I got in return, and told taxpayers, here's the deal you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, this is the taxpayers' contract.
Right.
They're
right.
the ones who are going to have to pay for it. And they're the ones who are going to have service delivery affected by it.
Ken Gerardin is here of the Yankee Institute, and we're talking about Governor Lamont's administration and the new terms being negotiated with the state employee unions. I'm curious, Ken, first of all, just some housekeeping here. How often do they go in and fix these contracts? And does the governor, whoever's in office, do they typically release those documents weeks in advance to the public? Like you were saying, it'd be nice to know that, first of all, state lawmakers could have seen these documents 3 weeks ago, or that we could understand what the governor's getting out of it. Is it typical for the public to know those things and ahead of time?
Unfortunately, in Connecticut, the tradition has been to keep this information away from the public for as long as possible.
Mm.
So these contracts typically get negotiated every 3 or 4 years, more or less. Some of the exceptions are the rules that govern health insurance and pensions for state workers. At one point, the state was under a 20-year deal. So we went from, we had a deal that was negotiated in 1997 that remained in force until it got partially renegotiated in 2017. And then it was only, and I say that in air quotes, a 10-year deal. So you have these deals that tend to remain in force long after the elected officials who vote on them or who negotiate them are in office. How many times did we change governors between 97 and 2017?
Right.
And you start to wonder, what's the point of having elections if folks are going to get into office and they're already going to have their hands tied on really important issues? And to be clear on a couple things, first off, I've got nothing against state workers. They get a really, really, really sweet deal. My concern is that the folks who, and this is my big second concern, my concern is that the folks who are making decisions around these contracts, either to negotiate them or to ratify them, are tying the hands of future elected officials and making it harder for them to deal with reality. I mean, one of the best examples of that is, you might remember, summer 2020, when unemployment was over 10%, mm-hmm. 1 in 6 residents had lost their jobs.
Right.
On the private sector side, 1 in 6 private sector jobs had disappeared between February and May. You had the state essentially out of money. You had the state on its way to being out of money very soon. And what happened? You had automatic 3.5% raises kick in for state workers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not something that any household or any business would do in the normal course of things. No one would go and give raises when things were that bad.
Right.
But that's what happened in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And then there were subsequent raises about 6 months after that. So you had folks who were getting 5.5% raises while their neighbors were on unemployment for most mm-hmm. of the year.
Right. And I think that's one of the things that is troubling when I saw this email come in late Friday, Ken, was, first of all, I thought of the postal workers. I thought of the grocery store workers. I thought of the media, people like you and me, who continued doing their jobs during the pandemic. And there were no raises. There were no changes. There were pay cuts. There were people laid off. There was a lot that, as you mentioned, if you weren't a state worker, you suffered. And you know, you've got the restaurant industry. You've got, small shops. I could go on and on. And I just think when you hear about this, I would think for the average taxpayer, again, you're talking about 44,000 state workers. And I have friends who are state workers. I'm very happy for them. However, you know, not being a state worker, more on the majority side in Connecticut, this would be very hard to swallow, especially because we are essentially paying for it as a taxpayer.
You and I could start a great reality show where we take the terms from state worker contracts. No, follow me here.
Yeah.
We could take the terms from state worker contracts, and you could have hidden cameras of us sitting down and talking to our bosses saying, this is what we want. Like, we want all these holidays. This is the pension rules we want. This is what we want to pay for lunch every day. This is what we want in terms of raises. These are the automatic raises that we want promised multiple years ahead. Like, can you do that for me? And then just record the response.
Mm.
And then hopefully we still have jobs after.
I was just going to say, I mean, the only reason I love this idea, I think the only thing is my bosses would laugh in my face. Not because they don't love me, because they do. We have an amazing relationship. But that's just, it's just a different reality than what
it
state
is
workers. That's just
a different
crazy.
Reality.
Yeah.
It absolutely is a different reality. Don't forget, the state workers were covered for years and years. This only expired last summer. The state workers were covered for years by a no layoff guarantee. And I don't want to see anybody lose their jobs. But show me any place else in the world that the employer will voluntarily tie their own hands for years at a time. And this was something, you know, most recently the Governor Malloy was responsible. It wasn't Governor Lamont's concoction. But show me any other place where you would say, regardless of whether we have the money to pay folks, we promise we're going to give raises and we're not going to lay anybody off.
Right.
It doesn't happen in reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that Connecticut taxpayers need to know as their lawmakers start poring over these same 1,700-page documents. Be- because the Senate and the State House are expected to vote to approve this. They are expected to rubber stamp this. Now, the fortunate thing is, looking further back in Connecticut history, when you had it's not an apples to apples comparison, but when you had labor agreements coming up in the early 90s, the House and the Senate, and these are members of both parties, got together and they said no repeatedly in the 90s. I think 1994, they rejected something like 10 contracts during the course of the year.
Interesting.
So the General Assembly does have a history of going and saying, like, no, thank you. Try again.
But especially, like you said, during an election year, though, what are the chances of that happening this time around?
You know, that's a good question. But 1994 was an election year, too. 1994 was the General Assembly was up, the governor was up, and you had higher inflation than you did in subsequent years. So I think people should be looking and saying, what's going on with my constituents? Mm-hmm. How are their costs changing? And also, by the way, where are we getting the money to do this? The governor ostensibly has all this money to give raises, and a lot of it is because the tax increases under Governor Malloy remained in effect.
Right.
Because we're still paying a 6.35% instead of 6% sales tax.
Yeah.
Because Governor Malloy ostensibly needed that to patch up the budget. We've had all these tax increases go through under Governor Rell and then under Governor Malloy. All these what should have been temporary increases have remained in effect.
Mm.
And unfortunately, they've become Governor Lamont's walking around money in the years since.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Kendra Arnon, again, with the Yankee Institute, we always appreciate having you on the show. And certainly we're going to continue looking into this and having these conversations. And I look forward to chatting with you very soon.
Thanks, Melissa. And folks can check yankeeinstitute.org, and we'll be posting analysis of this as we develop it.
All right. Excellent. Kendra Arnon, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
The latest from the state capitol about your own neighborhood. Connecticut Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff stops by Melissa in the morning. Now on WICC 600.
Good morning, Senator Duff. Thank you for being here. How are you?
Good morning. How are you? A little heartbroken today, but I'm doing okay.
I know. Our Huskies. I know. I'm assuming that's what you're talking about.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay. Just making sure, because I'm thinking, I don't want to assume, but it is a bummer. But still proud. I mean, man, we're still the best in the country for women's basketball. So it's...
Well, look at it this way. It's we may be disappointed that they didn't win the championship, but they get there all the time. And
exactly.
It's almost like our expectations are that they get to the Final Four, they're the Big East champs, we're heartbroken when they don't make it to the end. But they play their hearts out each and every day, and we should be so proud of what the Huskies, especially that team, the women's team, and Coach Oriema have done for the state of Connecticut and for our flagship university. It's just been remarkable.
I agree. I totally agree. We kind of get spoiled, we expect it, but the work that they do, I mean, for decades now, is just is amazing.
Yeah.
And I was saying to our listeners, it really attracts people from all over the country and even in other countries to come to UConn, to come to Connecticut, just because of the Huskies, just because of Husky pride.
Absolutely. It's put us on the map. And I think that's what helped launch UConn 2000, UConn 21st Century,
mm-hmm.
and to rebuild our flagship university, and which has made UConn so competitive even to get into nowadays at the main campus. But that's all great stuff. And the kids who go there now are just so smart, and they represent our state really well. And the fact of the matter is that about 80% of the kids who graduate from UConn stay in the state. So by attracting that talent, really helps our state in the long run. So by the mere fact of having great basketball teams or great sporting teams in general, that helps our state in many, many ways. So we should be proud, and not only because of the fact of what they do and how they carry themselves, because they do carry themselves really well, but the fact that it how it it helps our state in general.
Yeah. No, that's a very good point. I love that. Senator Duff, Friday night happened to have been when we clinched the finals. UConn clinched the finals. But also Friday afternoon, a very big announcement came from Governor Lamont's administration. And I just want to make this very clear to our listeners. Senator Duff, as far as I know, is not in these meetings. This is an administration kind of behind closed doors meeting that they have. But I wanted to get your take on it because I have some mixed emotions on this. And I think a lot of my listeners probably do, too. The governor's administration, as you know, reached a tentative, I'm going to call it, agreement, because essentially the General Assembly has to give it the sign of approval. And I'm talking about the bargained contracts with state employees, their union. This is, and my listeners are very aware of it, you know, we're talking about wage increases, bonuses, a lot for our state employees. And again, it's about 44,000 people in Connecticut who are state employees. I think the thing, there's a couple of things with this that I'd love to get your take on. First of all, there have been calls to have the governor be more public about this, like giving these documents out with enough time so the General Assembly can really have the time to look through them. But also why it seems like it's been kind of behind closed doors and the general public, who essentially the taxpayers will be paying for all this, for all these benefits, why it's been kind of kept from the public. Could you weigh in on that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just say at the offset that I have to go through the details a little bit further. We have not been briefed on it. We have not caucused it in our own Senate Democratic Caucus. And as far as I know, I would assume neither have any of the other caucuses in the legislature as well.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, so the CBAC agreement is basically it takes all of the unions that encompass the state employees. So whether it's folks who work at UConn, or whether it's people who work at the DOT or work at another state agency, the Attorney General's office, whatever, they all kind of come together they form this coalition to negotiate healthcare for their own healthcare and pensions, and basically for that. Now, each union itself will negotiate their own pay increases.
Sure.
But you basically have one coalition, CBAC, which negotiates the health and pensions. And that was actually a Republican idea many years ago. I think it was around the John Rowland time. And that was for more efficiency, to say, okay, instead of having every union negotiate their own health and pensions, or retirement at the time, we will just do it at one time. So that's basically what CBAC, that's why it seems like a huge agreement that way, because it's various bargaining units. And then each unit generally decides, or negotiates, their own pay.
Mm-hmm.
But they generally tend to be very similar, and in this case, I think they are, except for the state police. And so,
except for the state police?
They've decided to do their own thing.
Got it. Okay.
For whatever reason. And so that's why, you know, you have this kind of general universal agreement. So in the past, people have seen CBAC agreements, you know, extended, you know, like John Rowland did it for 20 years, which was unprecedented and will probably never happen again, because it tied the hands of state government for forever.
Mm-hmm.
But you then saw Dan Malloy renegotiate CBAC twice, and I think I mentioned this last week, and I've mentioned in the past, two different agreements that are saving the state about $40 billion over 20 years. That had to do with different tiers, because when you get hired, you're a certain tier of employee. So now people who are hired are what's called Tier 4. They pay more for their health, more for their pension. We don't have we actually have a pension / 401k hybrid now, so that's been saving a lot of money. So, and also on top, and for retirees as well, saving a ton of money. We have now the state employees on Medicare Advantage versus being on the state health care.
Okay.
And so that's been saving a lot of money. And at the same time, we've reduced the workforce quite a bit to, I think, per capita, where like 1950s levels for state employees. So all of that said, there's still this kind of large universal agreement that's out there. And frankly, we're expecting a huge retirement that's going to be happening probably around July 1st, because, again, what Governor Malloy negotiated was on June 30th of this year. If you don't retire, you go into your retirement will change. So,
right.
For example,
yep. Mm-hmm.
You may have if you retire this by June 30th, you may be guaranteed a 2 or 2.5% COLA as a minimum each year going forward. I'm just kind of,
right.
I think that's the number. That may not be the exact number, but it's somewhere around it. And if you retire after that, you're not guaranteed a particular number. So, so we expect potentially a third of state employees to retire. Now, that then comes down to the fact of, can state government still continue to function with so many retirements, and at the same time, the fact that our workforce has shrunk so much over the last 10 years. So I think that's where the idea of the bonuses came, to try and keep people employed, and at the same time, the fact that you have a tremendous amount of pressure from between the public sector and the private sector right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for example, if you need an engineer, DOT, it takes a long time to hire state employees. Sometimes it takes 6 months to hire somebody. Private sector can do it much quicker. We have different rules and ways of operating than the private sector does on that.
Sure.
So it takes longer. So in some ways, you want to be able to retain your workforce, just like the private sector does.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's some of the reasons why. So I'm still going through some of this, but some of this may be speculation. But I think that that's part of the reason. And again, so I just want to give for your listeners to know that our workforce is the smallest it's been in decades. We've saved taxpayers about $40 billion over 20 years in costs, on health and pension costs, and also in long-term costs as well. And the fact that we have this big retirement coming up, and so there's got to be ways in which we can retain some of the workforce, but also still be competitive when it comes to hiring as well. Because, you know, in the past, people would come to state government because of the fact that the health benefits were so much superior, or they had these, you know, pensions versus what the private sector did not do. The pensions are pretty much gone now because of the 401k hybrid thing that we have. So we got to figure out other ways in which we can retain a workforce and still have, you know, good quality people who want to work for the state and serve the public.
We have a couple more minutes with Senator Duff, and we were talking about the contract negotiations still up for a vote, though, by the General Assembly, and this has to do with state workers. I think you made a lot of good points, Senator Duff, and I even just looking at the state police, I know you and I have talked about that and the fact that we've lost dozens of state police because of the change for 2022 and their pensions, and I get it, anticipating the fact that we're going to lose more state workers by this summer. I totally understand that. I think what's hard about this is that for anyone who's not a state worker, it's really challenging to see that in the private sector, people were laid off, had their pays cut. And again, that's nothing that the state can really do. That comes down to an employer. But in the meantime, when it comes to just being a taxpayer, it feels like it took, you know, a lot of time just to get like a gas tax cut, to give an example, because it was going to cost the state a lot of money and all of that. So it feels like the state workers are getting money for the pandemic, which, you know, I love the state workers. I respect what they do. But it feels like taxpayers in general who are not state workers are still just kind of feeling the pain of the pandemic. And there's really no relief coming from the state in that regard. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. But I would also say that, you know, in defense of what many of them have done, don't forget they were all working during the pandemic. So you still had people who were part of the Department of Children and Families, who were caring for abused kids.
Sure.
Who worked throughout the pandemic. You had people at the DOT still plowing and still doing their job, showing up every day, who worked during the pandemic. People at the DMV, you know, who are working during the pandemic. So, I mean, our state government still functioned, and they still worked through it. And I don't, you know, I think the issue sometimes is that it becomes a them versus us, and I don't think that anybody wants to do that. I think what we're seeing right now is because we saw 400,000 jobs created nationally over the last month, is that there's a tremendous amount of competition for workers. And so, you know, people like I look at a lot of people in the attorney general's office who are attorneys. They could be making 2-3 times the amount of money in the private sector than they are in the public sector. And we need them supporting us. You know, anytime if people are looking at price gouging right now, for example, for any particular issue, they go to the attorney general's office because they need, that's where we go. And those attorneys who help make sure that we're not getting gouged or they're fighting for us on settlements for like Purdue Pharma or other types of things, they could be literally making 2-3 times the salary in the private sector. So we need to retain those bright minds to represent us in the state. Same with Department of Consumer Protection. You know, a lot of times people go to that agency for whether it's for enforcement, liquor laws, for what we're doing on marijuana, what we're doing, you know, in the gaming or any number of things, licensing. You know, we need those people to be able to be there and that arm of government to function so that people who are realtors or plumbers or carpenters can be licensed and make sure that we have, you know, people want to look up those licenses, that it's there and they have that ability. So, mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of government that we don't see every day, but we depend on because it's just always there. And so, you know, when we have an elderly person who is at a nursing home, and if they're not being treated well, who do we call? We call the state to check in on them. Who regulates the hospitals? The state regulates the hospitals. So, you know, all those people out there, we got to have working and ensuring that they are looking out for our state laws, our state regulations, and basically keeping people safe.
No, and I totally agree with that, Senator Duff, and I certainly don't want it to be a them versus us idea, but, you know, I could probably also rattle off a lot of industries that also stayed open, like grocery store workers, like postal store, you know, so that's all I'm saying is that I think if you're not a state worker, it becomes very challenging to feel excited that we're going to spend millions of dollars for a certain type of person living in Connecticut when everyone else is sort of going, okay, well we struggled through the pandemic.
But I disagree with your everybody else, because I don't think that's everybody else. That is maybe a certain segment of folks, and that's probably true, because there were people who were laid off, people who like the restaurant industry, but the restaurant industry is roaring back like crazy.
There's also a lot that are still struggling, though.
Of course, there's people still struggling, and we need to help them. But that doesn't mean we don't do something at somebody else, you know, because somebody else is struggling. We don't work to keep jobs competitive in one way. But a lot of the private sector right now, you know, if you're say an engineer, they're literally trying to hire you out of college, your freshman or sophomore year or junior year, because they need the people to do the jobs. So I just don't agree with the characterization that, you know, everybody's struggling or that that there's, you know, this is the only type of job. There's the jobs right now are hugely competitive, and competing with the private sector is very difficult right now if you're in the public sector. The private sector has all the advantages right now. The public sector does not.
Okay. Well, Senator Duff, I do appreciate you giving us extra time to talk about this.
Of course.
And looking forward to talking to you next week.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
What's going on in the Capitol and how it affects you? State Senator Tony Wong joins Melissa in the morning right now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Let's just keep the conversation rolling. If you missed it, we just chatted with Senator Duff a few minutes ago about the latest announcement from Governor Lamont's administration. Friday afternoon, they have come up with basically a tentative agreement with the union representing state workers, and it includes bonuses, wage increases, and I think the biggest takeaway from this is what's being done for the private sector, essentially. You know, what is the state doing to give back a lot of the money that we've been paying as taxpayers, especially from the pandemic? Now, did everyone struggle in the pandemic in some regard? No. But a lot of industries did. I could tell you at least probably the same amount, if not more, of the 44,000 state workers. I guarantee you tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people in Connecticut in the private sector did struggle in the pandemic. And that's where people are upset. It shouldn't be a them versus, you know, them versus us, a private versus public sector. But unfortunately, this conversation has kind of become that, which I don't want it to become, Senator Huang. But I do want to talk about the fact of how this conversation has been done behind closed doors, and the fact that there are a lot of people in Connecticut who are not thrilled about these potential contracts being probably, well, they're going to be voted on, but probably getting the green light from the General Assembly. So let's start there. Good morning, first of all. Thank you for being here. What is sort of your take on the contracts
for
the workers?
Good morning to you and your listeners. It's always great to talk to you. And I do appreciate the efforts of the state workers. And you're right. It shouldn't be us versus them. And I don't begrudge them on this contract, despite my concerns about it, you know, because as a state employee, if the governor and the state legislature approves it and gives it to them, if I was a state employee, I would say thank you very much and
absolutely,
go away and pocket the money. So it's not the state employees. Look, you negotiate to get the best deal. And if the caretakers and the legislative responsibility says, sure, I'll give it to you, then we're not doing the right thing, because we've forgotten that this is the taxpayers' agreement with the unions. This is the taxpayers who will foot the bill. And ultimately, I have a number of concerns. Despite the simplicity of the announcement that is late Friday afternoon, believe me, there are a lot of other releases that came out during the week talking about the good things the governor did. But, you know, to tuck it under late Friday afternoon is, you know, in the news business, that's a hideaway announcement. This is one where you want to hope it goes away over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So it really brings out the concern about transparency and accountability. You know, this is a taxpayer's liability over the long term. And details were not completely released. You know, the Yankee Institute did a great interview with you. And even for them, they were aware of this since March 8th.
Mm-hmm.
To them, they have gotten the details of over 1,500 pages of details that govern not just the simple statements that were made, that you're going to have 2.5% wage increases for the next 3 years, that there's a $3,500 bonus for the next 2 years, each totaling $3,500. But the devil's in the details: work rules, vacation days, and the accruement of benefits, the pensions. 1,500 pages and not a detail about it.
Mm.
Fortunately, with the release, now it has to go to the nonpartisan Office of Fiscal Analysis, which will do a fiscal note and calculate the impact of these budgets in its entirety, and how it impacts the budget. So I think it's important to note that if you've been talking about this for months and months, and if an agreement was released on March 8th for the union to vote on it, and the public knows nothing about this.
Right.
But wait a second. It's even worse. The legislative body didn't know the details about it.
Well, Senator Duff said that himself. He said, I can only speak to so much about it because I haven't gotten through the document myself. I mean,
isn't that amazing? The various imparted parties, he is the Senate Majority Leader, and we're not privy. If we're not privy, then who is? Just the governor and the union negotiators. That is a lack of transparency and accountability. Number two is the fact that, you know, we've been governed for the last 2 years under an executive order in which this level of transparency, this level of accountability was never asked of this governor. And people need to understand, we run a people's government, a representative government that has not had a habit of making themselves readily available on the information that may not look good for them.
Mm-hmm.
So the transparency accountability is an important question. And it's a real problem for me that we've got a contract that's going to bind the taxpayers for the next 3 years, at least, and nobody knows about it. And now we're going to have to vote on it. And Ken is absolutely correct. Until 5 years ago, when it was 18-18 tied, Republican in Senate and Democrats in the Senate, we were passing labor agreements without a vote. Because
right,
under the rules of the legislature, if an agreement is reached and it doesn't get acted upon by the legislature, which has the final authority to approve it,
mm-hmm,
it automatically goes into effect.
Right.
And I've had that situation where we debated the budget or we debated the labor agreements in many, many ways in the Appropriations Committee, and no vote was cast.
So, Senator Huang, at least now you do have the General Assembly who has to look at it. Senator Huang is here, and we're talking about the tentative agreement for the state worker contracts. And really quick, Senator Huang, I want to reiterate this for our listeners so that they're clear. The money that is going to go into these bonuses, these wage increases for state workers, that is coming directly out of taxpayer wallets, correct? We are not pulling this from the COVID money, from the ridiculous, I'm going to call it ridiculous amounts of money Connecticut has right now, correct? It's going to come out of our pockets.
Absolutely. And even the COVID money is taxpayer money. And unfortunately, we've had a tremendous luxury of billions of dollars that kind of camouflaged our real true cost of budgeting. And that's a problem because we're forecasted by the objective nonpartisan office that In the next year, the next budget session year, starting in 2023 to 24, we're already calculated to have $2 billion in deficit based upon the budget as it is. And that doesn't include the new programs that we're thinking about implementing, necessary programs. So it really is short-sighted and very much camouflaged by COVID dollars. So I have extreme concerns in regards to budgetary. Again, it's a taxpayer's budget and the lack of transparency and accountability. The other important part, Melissa, I'll leave you on, is the fairness factor. You've got nonprofits that are working during this time, our frontline healthcare workers, our grocery workers, many of the people.
Postal workers, media workers, there are a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. They've all worked through, and there's a real big push in regards to hazard pay for them. What do you say to them when you give this contract in which no state employee lost their jobs? What do you say to the countless other people that did lose their jobs?
That's what I was trying to get at.
Are struggling.
Yes.
I mean, our restaurants are struggling because the reality is that's why we passed the outdoor dining is they're not flourishing because the ones that are doing great. But we still have restaurants closing.
Right.
And the problem I have is the fairness factor for many other employees, like I said, I don't blame the state employees because if we're going to give it to them as caretakers of the taxpayers' responsibility as a governor and as a state legislature, the state employees are not going to say, no, 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 I won't take it. But what do you say to all these other hardworking people dealing with an inflationary cost? And what do you say to those people who lost their jobs?
Well, and that's what I was trying to come across. That's the fairness. And I wanted to make that very clear. Look, if I wasn't going to say anything, but like blatantly, for anyone who thinks I don't love state workers, my very best friend is a DCF worker. Okay, I love her to pieces. And when I heard this contract, I got to be honest with you, Senator Huang, I was very happy for her. My immediate thought was she deserves it. State workers deserve it. I also know that many state troopers, which is not included in this, I know that state troopers, they're retiring. I know a lot of state workers have to retire, so we can't really have that happen. I'm in agreement with them, and I'm not fighting this because I don't want them to benefit. They deserve to benefit. Look, my friend who works in DCF, she was still doing house calls when there was a full-blown pandemic in March and April. She was still going door-to-door knocking when we weren't even required to wear masks. So I'm not saying they should not get bonuses or increases or anything like that. I get that. With that being said, though, it took us a year and a day, it felt like, just to pass a measly gas tax cut to help everyone. And the big thing we kept hearing was, oh, we can't get rid of the gas tax because if we do that, that's costing $98 million and that could have gone towards our roads. Who cares? We gave insane amounts during the pandemic when virtually almost any other state didn't do that during the pandemic. And we're not seeing any of our COVID money come back. That's the frustration here. It's not that the state workers shouldn't benefit. They should. I think it's great. But what about the other people? I'm not going to say the rest because I've already been told I shouldn't say everyone. How about a lot of the other people living in Connecticut who either worked through the pandemic or lost their jobs because of the pandemic and aren't seeing any financial relief? None.
And who is representing them, Melissa? And if I can close by simply saying this, are we representing 44,000 value state employees, or are we representing 2.5 million Connecticut residents that are struggling mightily and do not have the job security and the wage increases and the bonuses that are being offered to them when they're struggling to just make the day go get by?
Right.
That's the struggle is.
Right. Represent both of them.
The fairness in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because like I
and
said,
it's frustrating.
It's not them versus us. You should represent the state workers. But again, 2.5 million people, and I'll even be generous and say, okay, it's not everyone. Another 1.5 million? I think that's fair. I think that's fair to say. Probably triple the amount of your state workers are not seeing any relief. And we have so much money. So much money.
And do you not think that the agreeers to this and the public relations side is cognizant of that lack of fairness, a lack of equal representation and transparency?
They're
to
not
have it
if
released.
People don't bring it to their attention. That's the whole point of this. I think most people
well,
would
I'm
have
glad
no
we're
idea.
Having this conversation. I'm glad we're having this conversation, but I have to tell you, let me begin by saying it's a fairness issue, it's a transparency and accountability issue. We've had 2 years of the governor running by executive order where many people felt as though their voices weren't heard. And you know, to this day, I don't know enough details about this agreement that's 1,500 pages, and they didn't make it easier. As Ken Jardine said, they're not making it easier for you to find this and to research it and break it down. Even for the Yankee Institute, it took him 3 days to read through the details. It's incredibly frustrating for a document that affects every taxpayer in the state of Connecticut and have to live with that burden down the road. It's flat out outright lack of transparency and respect for the taxpayers when we should be representing them. And a fairness factor. Mm-hmm. Let's leave it at that. It's patently unfair to the people that we are supposed to represent.
Senator Wong, we appreciate you weighing in on this conversation and giving us insight. Thank you so much, and we'll talk again next week.
Thank you, Melissa. Have a great day.
You too.